welcome to... We're back! This episode of the Imaginary Movie Podcast, a podcast where once every 6 weeks or so, we sit down and we talk about a movie. So, grab your spice, Sam, and get in your... Oh, fuck, what are they called? Gyrocopter? Verticopter? Vertibirds?
Dragonfly machines.
Dragonfly machines. Get in your, like, physics impossible dragonfly machines, and let's go and blow up some indigenous people. My name's David.
Wow, clip that. My name's Sam. I'm certainly on my spice tonight, Dave. I am spiced up. Let's spice this, spice out of this. Also, Dave, please don't draw attention to the fact that we are slightly behind in schedule. Don't draw attention to our failure to consistently put out a podcast. Yes, but don't worry.
Maybe
don't worry,
the first time, maybe the first time in, what, 4 years? Is it 4 years?
It's amazing.
We have missed two consecutive weeks due to illness.
Yeah.
I think that's not bad. That's pretty good.
We'll do it. Fuck you. We're not pod fading. We refuse. We will not pod fade. If we go out, Dave, it's going to be in a gigantic sandstorm and preferably eaten by a worm. I'm not sure we can get
sandworm. On hallucinogenic, mind-altering space drugs.
This sounds like a great idea for a book. Do you not think we could?
Sam, for a really self-indulgent, really long, really winding, really pointless.
Maybe published in like the mid-60s, something like that. Yeah, like this
that's
is
right,
perfect.
Yeah, absolutely.
Like post Asimov, you know, he's dead, but we're really leaning into the tortured analogies. And the real kind of long-winded... This is like a 900-page book, I think. Something like that. Did that seem about right to you? You know? And then several decades later...
Isaac Asimov died in 1992. I was like, he didn't die in the 60s.
So it's... Okay, so it's mid-Asimov then.
Peak Asimov, you might say.
Peak, yeah. But not... So we've got this 900-page book, and then we're going to make loads of tortured TV series and a crap movie about it. And then in 2020-odd, we're going to make two massive movies that are like 3 hours long. And yet...
Yeah.
Oh, hold on, listener. Hold on. Before you say, oh, here's another podcast where these guys moan about a movie, I actually really like this film. This is a surprise. I was surprised. I am eating my words and saying... Yeah, this movie from 2021 is actually quite good. Shock horror.
I will say the David Lynch 80s movie is actually supposed to be pretty good.
I haven't seen it. But it was like, I think I was like dead young, so I have no idea. But
before we attack the whole like basis of this, I think that movie's fairly well thought of.
Yeah.
And there's a pretty decent board game. Like the...
Oh, dear.
This is one of these weirdly like... There's one of these properties that's kind of like never gone away. We're going to talk about this as we go through this because this is a way better film. But John Carter of Mars, whatever the fuck that film was called.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is based on a huge...
By famed old, eugenicist. Yes, yeah, go on.
Problematic sci-fi series. But that kind of like there was a resurrection of a series that no one had been talking about for 70 years. whereas Dune is kind of like you said, we had the series in the 80s, the film in the 80s, and books have continued to be made even since Frank Herbert died. Like his son, I think, wrote a few more because obviously nepotism.
Thank you, Count Nepo. Thank you, that's great.
Count Nepo, baby. Wah! Sorry, we should...
One undeserving role.
we should really... develop that more thoroughly. But anyway,
Hold on. Hold on, I'm not moving back. So we're developing the count from Sesame Street as some kind of like what is he calling out nepotism, or is he applauding it, or is he just like obviously he would have his own nepotism in his children.
He is the personification of the. The especially Hollywood nepotism, because old-fashioned nepotism still exists. I mean, look at, you know, the peerage.
Fucking royal family who
banking or
yeah,
anything
yeah.
in finance, but Hollywood nepotism. And so count nepotism Count Nepo Baby is the personification of Hollywood nepotism. So he is inexplicably a Muppet vampire baby.
He's not a baby though. He's a grown up. He's a grown up man. So this is my question: is he?
But with baby features, he's got to be wearing a nappy, right?
Is he Drew Barrymore? Is he Drew Barrymore? Is he Lionel Barrymore? Which at the end of the spectrum is he?
He's
the result
Sylvester
of the
Nepo?
Sylvester Stallone
in Stop on My Mum Will Shoot in that dream sequence, but he's also a vampire. Very confused.
That sentence makes absolutely no sense. But I think, well, let's come back to it. So anyway, June. There's lots of shit about this. Like, this movie, I think,
it has stayed quite in the, not forefront maybe, but like, this is a series that has fans, has continued to have fans, and has continued to have relevance, and like, been quite well thought of for 60 years, you know, and that's quite impressive in itself, because I think sci-fi generally, a lot of narrative sci-fi like this ages quite poorly, I think. Because sci-fi is capturing that kind of like the culture of the time and kind of distilling it into this unreal thing, and then 20 years later, like a look back at the Back to the Future. Now we're past the future and Back to the Future. Like, you know, that has aged poorly in terms of the way that the future was supposed to play out. And
yeah,
you know,
I would like to talk about the Lord of the Rings, because. Stay with me here. I think this movie, like, and the progress that we've seen from the TV series and the book and then the film, the David Lynch film, and all of this, like, I think so much of it to get to the point where we are now comes from Hollywood, not it's not even a Hollywood movie, is it really? But the films in general being able to take huge, massive, incomprehensible, treacle-like books like The Lord of the Rings. Love you, Tolkien, my man, but Jesus Christ, please give us a break. Like, we are taking all of that and we are adapting it to the screen, and we are creating really successful movies. And I think, to me, Lord of the Rings is like the absolute pinnacle of this, because you can't get much better in terms of adaptation and how they did that. To me, I think so much comes from that this movie, and probably a lot of the type of, almost like Game of Thrones as well, you know, being able to translate what's happening in a book that's so dense and so much detail and so dense, and oh my God, Frank Herbert, this is so dense, like, to be able to translate that onto the screen and to make it interesting and attractive and make sense. Like, I don't think Hollywood knew how to do that in the 80s. And I think we can do it now. And we can do it certainly on TV. And that's what we've had, the golden age of TV, isn't it? We've had the ability to take
these
big
stories.
Like
you said, I think Game of Thrones is a great comp for this, because it's a complex political story, which is what Dune is really. It's kind of like this political drama that's playing out in this fantastical world. But I think trusting your audience to follow along, or like yourself, not even follow along, but just be entertained, like, regardless of the fact there's lots in this movie that doesn't make sense, there's lots of like kind of like prophecy things, there's a lot of stuff is out of order, it's actually quite confusing, intentionally so. And I think even 10 years ago this sort of movie would have been relegated to, like, you know, Christopher Nolan, like, experimental cinema type things, you know,
or John Carter, like you've mentioned, it's almost the same, you know, movie, like Chosen One, Lands of the Planet, fuck shit up, blue people, blah blah blah, middle, like, it's the same type of science fiction stretch that I think.
Oh, no, absolutely, it is the same kind of story. What I mean is, it's not the same kind of film. I think this film, Dune Part One, what it does, and you've read the book, haven't you?
Yeah, I have, yeah.
Because we're fucking, like, degenerate nerds, so we've read the book. But only the first one. I'm exactly the sort of degenerate nerd who's read the first Dune book and never another one.
And gone. 900,
I feel it's really important to establish that.
For your own, 900 pages? I'm not doing this again. No, but what? No, what, but I'm agreeing with you. What I'm saying, saying is, I'm is saying that
the story follows it quite closely. I just want to make my point here before we move away from it. The story follows it quite closely and trusts the audience to kind of like accept the complexities and accept that, especially this being Dune Part One, is we're going to tell the story. We're going to tell it how it originally appeared, more or less. And we're going to trust our viewers to be entertained enough and be invested enough that they're willing to wait 2 years to have some of these things pay off.
Some of these, yeah. But I'm agreeing because with
this
though.
Is not a perfect movie in that respect. This does not pay off everything it sets up quite intentionally so because it's doesn't. The first movie.
Because it's the first movie. But I'm agreeing with what you're saying, because if you're saying that if they made this 10 years earlier, you wouldn't be able to achieve that, and I think audiences would also wouldn't be able to achieve that. And what I'm suggesting is that they did make this ten. They made John Carter, Oh, no, it's not the same film, and I know the scale of the audience is very different. That's a weird, you know, eugenics Disney movie, but
just like all the other eugenics,
yeah, just like all of them, like you know. But at the same time, I think there is something there that audiences, you're right, are now able to have complex stories, to have massive story arcs and loads of characters. And that's why I said Lord of the Rings. That's why even to an extent like Harry Potter, like we've got fucking 8 movies and there's thousands of characters in that film. It's impossible to keep up with it unless you are willing to put the work in. Now, Dune isn't quite that because it is more contained. But I think there is still an element of I'm watching this and I'm going, and I've read the book a long time ago, to be fair, and I'm not very good at remembering plots. However,
fans of the podcast canon will know
Sam has
Sam's top Trump's card.
No idea what's going on. I am also, though, it kind of doesn't matter. Like, watching this movie is much about the experience and the emotion that you're feeling right now, as it is about the overall arc. And I really, really appreciate movies that don't let their story get in the way of making the audience feel something. And I think this movie manages to achieve that. And that's a hard thing to do. It's a hard thing to show me 2.5 hours of desert and people having conversations and to walk away going, wow, that was like I felt something. I actually connected with this.
It's a really clever way to establish the lore and the world. And I will say, let's straight off the bat, I think visually, obviously, and we say this every week, but it's really like people don't make movies look like shit anymore, apart from the obvious examples. But generally, like a high budget sci-fi movie is going to look pretty good. Generally, right?
We're not doing The Mummy. The Scorpion King, are we with the Rock's face?
Exactly. You know, it's now at a point where
it's never gonna happen again.
Anyone can make a movie look good, and I think this does look absolutely fantastic. But I think the production design, in terms of like the Dragonfly helicopters, which have a name, I'm sure, certain.
The Dragonfly helicopters, yes, that's right.
They look really cool. They're stupid as fuck, but they look really, really cool. The desert stuff is really good. The worms. Like the costuming, the look of this movie is really, really great, and also, like, quite dead on from the books. It's what to talk about Lord of the Rings. One of the things they really, really nailed in Lord of the Rings is over investing in the props and in like the strength of those books is the descriptions of the world that really makes it come alive. And by putting the time and the effort in to kind of like capture those things and put them on the screen for the viewers so that they can experience it in the same way that you would experience it reading the book, in a lot of ways, in the same sort of like depth of field.
Like the guys,
it allows
who...
you to, it makes the world feel so much more alive, even though actually Dune is a remarkably fucking sparse and not boring, but sparse and utilitarian kind of like world. It doesn't seem like that in this movie because they capture all the things from the book that I remember and kind of like bring it to like, you know, horrible detail. You know, like the sand is scary. The desert is scary. I think scarier than it is in the books.
And you need and you need that detail, don't you? I think so many adaptations that we see come from a place of like, they come from a place of trying to either cash in or to create a version that works for the film. And I think if you don't get that right, you can end up with a real, you can end up putting the movie in a position where it's having to do like all of the heavy lifting for a story that either isn't there enough, or there's way more under the surface that you kind of need to pull from. And you can't have it both ways. You can't create a book. You can't create a book that is going to translate perfectly to a film, and you can't create films that are just going to lift up a book and say, "We're just going to do it all." It's kind of what, like, I think the TV series, the Dune TV series, was accused of, is just being like so much exposition and so boring and blah blah. And I think, like, again, we just have a model for that now. We have a model for doing that in a way that works, that we can cut the shit, and I think TV writers, movie writers know how to do it.
Well, it's something this movie does well is, to a large extent, it's show, don't tell.
Which is hard to do. Like, the show, don't tell is hard to do, you know, and I think a lot of that comes from the detail that you've outlined in terms of the production. Physically, we get to see the scale of this planet.
Yeah, and also, it's important to note as well, like, you couldn't have told this in 2 hours. We are big advocates on this podcast for the 90-minute movie. That 88-minute fucking In-N-Out movie. Like, you would think we hate
the
movies,
seven-minute movie.
7-minute movie. Oh, fantastic. I was done. I blinked.
Including credits. But, that's 2 minutes of credits as well. Tell me your story.
But I think the length of this movie, and again, 10 years ago, yeah, I thought, you know, 155 minutes, what's that? Two hours 35. Is that right? Maths isn't my...
Don't do maths on the air. Golden rule, number one of broadcasting. Continue. But,
like, by making this movie 2 hours and 35 minutes, I think it allows you ample time to kind of, like, drip-feed the audience all these things about the world, and we get... So let's talk about... Can we talk about the plot a little bit?
Let's talk about those specific things, because we've been quite general.
But it gets to drip-feed, like, the world, which is that we're on this... So there's a vast space... monarchy. there's a vast space world, and we're going to follow the Atreides mostly, and the Harkonnen. Pronunciation, by the way, get fucked if you're going to argue me about
it. Yeah, you're corrected us. Yeah,
exactly. Yeah, Atreides X and tell me what a cunt I am. So the Atreides are kind of like our good guys. They're our white hats. Harkonnen are the Sith, basically. That's the one thing I was like, you couldn't have maybe just... I get it. Like, the Nazis really, really changed the game on who the bad guys are and what they look like and why they all wear black leather all the time. I get that. It's a massive, massive thing. Good. I understand.
Good. Yeah.
Good. but yes, you've got the Harkonnen and the Atreides, and they're on a planet called Arrakis. And we've got these indigenous people who are the Fremen, who live in the deserts. And we kind of established that there's an emperor, vague emperor, and I don't really... This is the great thing about this, is I remember the foundation. I remember basically all the stuff it tells you in the start of this movie, I remembered from the book. And all the actual details of everything else, I've forgotten. And we're on Arrakis, because on Arrakis, we're farming spice, which is the biggest fucking MacGuffin going.
Yeah.
It's a psychoactive drug that makes you see the future if you're a special chosen special boy. Powers spaceships? ?
I think the space isn't the space, and I might be wrong, and please tell us, audience, but I think isn't it to do as well, because there isn't really like computers, and so the spice helps people to like do them, because we see one of the Atreides guys, like, his eyes roll back,
yeah,
and
he manages
to do a massive song
in the novels. There's a faction called the Spacers Guild. And yes, they are basically a bunch of, like you said, space magicians.
Math magicians.
And they take a load of drugs, basically, and they fucking hack their way through the Matrix.
And they
which
can
makes
compute
spacecraft.
Hyperdrive jumps, basically.
Yeah, basically, human hyperdrives is a great way.
they can say,
the movie actually doesn't get into it loads because we don't do a lot of that. And also, I think that would stretch the bounds of what you're willing to believe if the first 20 minutes of this movie, you've got some fucking pill-popping drug addict fucking hacking his way through time.
But there's the adaptation, isn't there? Because in the adaptation, I think you can skim over that. And all you need to know really is spice is important. Spice is the foundation of the economy and we need it because that's the, it's, you know, once you have... Once you have the spice, then you get the women. Like that, it's completely.
Once you get the spice, then you get the power. Then
you get the power. Then you get the women. Right.
Then
sorry, I skipped this.
Get the women.
Like so, that's where we're at. That's fine. Like I think as much as this story is massive, it's huge in terms of the universal scale of it, and we've got these factions, and we've got these blah 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 emperor, random names, the Sith are in there, and whatever else. Like, actually, when you break this story down, I think it is really small and it is really simply about we have the thing that's important that people want and how are these different factions going to get it. And that's to be fair to Herbert, that's a testament to, I think, his overall story. But also, it's oil, isn't it? I mean, we're here for oil, basically.
It's funny, actually.
We recognise that too.
Yeah, it's magic. It's magic beans. It's the MacGuffin. It's the total like... But it's interesting because Dune as a story is basically... And the reason it's, I think, remained so popular and interesting is because it kind of stands alone in the success of what it's trying to do. There's plenty of books that do it, but the success of... And there'll be a genre term for it, but this is basically like... This is... it's space fantasy. It's feudalism in space. That's what Dune is. The Atreides and the Harkonnen are fucking knights of the round cunt table. And there's an emperor, big fat, probably horribly disgusting, evil emperor, pulling all the strings. And it's an economics movie as well. So the whole like fulcrum of the plot, which we learn in this movie, is that the Atreides get sent to Arrakis, but it's like a trick because the emperor is jealous of their prestige, so they all get murdered. And in the book, I actually think it's a little bit harder to swallow. Like the big thing about Dune is that we don't use guns because someone has developed these personal shields, which are really, really good at, they'll stop anything, all fast moving projectiles. So it allows us to have sword fights in our like futuristic sci-fi movie.
Yeah,
which again, it's clever. I think the movie covers it pretty well. It allows you to have that kind of like armed combat thing, which is fun. But again, it lends itself to that kind of like, you know, sword and sandals movie in space.
Yeah, which is important, isn't it? Because a lot of it's about. I think there's a lot of it's about how. There's a lot of recognizable stories in there. It's a bit like Star Wars, isn't it? In that. Just nothing really we hadn't seen before, but it crystallizes something that I think is there. And I think, you know, the overall story does, it's interesting and it's compelling, and the character, I think it's the characters, and that's what I'd maybe want to get into next is
the cast
how
is very
well
good.
This cast is great, but
even
the characters,
Jason Momoa, who I think he's fantastic in this.
Just one last thing, though, because I did read this earlier and I was just, like, amazed. So Dune was published by Chilton Books, who almost universally published auto repair manuals and also Dune, like, one of the greatest science fiction successes of all times. Like, they also did The Witches of Caris in 1966. Both were nominated for a Hugo Award, and which Dune... one, and you just think, holy Jesus, how does this happen? How does a company founded in 1904 that basically just sold repair manuals manage to nab, you know, something like this? It's insane.
How did the tire company become the face of fine dining in the
fine
world?
Dining,
like,
I know.
Sam, it's the same thing of like
capitalism, baby.
Money,
works,
the finger
works.
Thing means money.
Let's talk about the characters. Let's talk about the character played by Timothy Chalamet, whose name I definitely know is Paul.
It's a white guy name. Everyone's got a white guy names.
I hate the names in Dune. I hated them in the book. I hate them now. What's the other one called?
Duncan Idaho.
It's atrocious. I mean,
that really feels like a placeholder, and we're like, I'll fix that. The editor will pick it up.
And then they couldn't
ideas.
Be bothered.
We'll fix
didn't
that.
Have find and replace, and they couldn't be bothered to go out and take out the 900 instances. Like, but I think Paul's quite an interesting character at the start of the movie because he is such a blank slate.
He's got, and there's a lot going on, and it in a lot of stories, I think it would be too much. So he's the son of this prominent
good guy.
Lord. Yep, the white hat, played by Oscar Isaac. That's Leto Atreides. He's a teenage white boy, which is great for sales of sci-fi novels. He's
just like me.
He's got mystical, magical powers from his mum. We'll dig into that in a minute. He's really sweet and cool at like slitting throats and stuff. Also dead cool. He's clever as fuck. He's total Mary Sue in the book. And I think they do tone that down in the film. He's a little bit more fallible.
And he's quite understated at the start of the movie, isn't he? More than, again, I remember
unsure
him being,
of himself. Yeah.
He is. And I think his arc and his progression from being this scared boy, really. I mean, he's not terrified, but he is apprehensive about what's happening, and he leans on the authority of his dad. And all of that is ripped away from him. And that progression for him becoming, like, at the end of the movie, he's in control. And to your point, it is a bit like, wow, this is proper fulfillment fantasy, isn't it? Because he gets to, like, boss his mum around now as well. No, mummy, I'm in charge now.
I think it's above the farm boy trope.
Yeah.
Which we see in loads of fiction. Like Star Wars, for instance, we see in loads of stuff.
Yeah.
And like, it's kind of what we see in this movie is his development as from, you know, the son who's unsure of himself and like all
but
the
I wanted to go to Tashi Station and get power converters. Yeah, yeah.
Exactly. We see him from being this unsure person who's like uncomfortable with the authority that he has because of who he was born to be.
Yeah.
And him trying to marry up this, like, his mum's some, like, weird space witch. I mean, I think that's the term they use, the Bene Gesserit. And he's got a bit of that going on. And there's this prophecy. And again, it's not too heavy in the movie. And the idea that kind of, like, he's going to do something really, really important. And until his dad dies, and I think Oscar Isaac, by the way, is such a good actor. I think he owns this role of, like, there's a gravitas to him as this Duke that I think pulls together the whole movie, and it does so much to complement Chalamet's performance in terms of, like, believably being his son. And, you know, if your dad was like, do you know what I mean? If your dad was this cool, authoritative, good looking, like benevolent, clever, like forward thinking, all of these great things, you would be a little bit unsure of yourself because how can I ever be as good as this guy? Yeah. And I think that's the casting, that's the writing, that's the performance. I think it works really well.
It does. I really like it. I don't think I would have loved him to be 10 years older. And I think there's like a 17-year gap, I think, or something like that anyway, between Chalamet and him, which is technically possible, but at the same time, like,
There's a 12-year gap between him and his mother, so.
I
get what you mean, Sam. I get what you mean.
I'll tell you the energy I wanted. Do you know the energy I wanted? I wanted I wanted Daddy Sutherland in Hunger Games. That's what I wanted. And sorry, it makes me laugh because there's the junior Kiefer. What's his name?
I get you, Sam.
What's his name? What's the older Sutherland guy? Not Kiefer Sutherland. No,
Donald Sutherland.
Donald Sutherland. I wanted D Donald, Daddy Donald Sutherland. That's the energy.
Do you know what? I'm here for it. I think you're right. I think, like, yeah, in an ideal world, maybe an actor who's 5 or 10 years older. But I also think that I think Oscar Isaacs is a better actor than a lot of the actors in that age range. Can you imagine Brad Pitt in this role? He's 55. Like Mark Wahlberg, Sam, he's 52 or something. Like, you, do you know what I mean? Like, I think what they got was an actor who could do a really good job, and the age thing didn't bother me. I think Oscar Isaacs looks like believably like he could be Chalamet's dad, partly because Chalamet is always playing younger than he is.
He's partly, 28, isn't he? And he looks
he's playing sort of like 20, 22-ish, and that's fine, and it works. And again, it's aged up a little bit from the books. But I think Oscar Isaac is great, and more roles where he can sort of like just play a character.
And I think that relationship is really key. There is, like, I think as the story progresses, and then obviously he dies, and that changes things quite a lot. And you see that progression, and just in terms of how it affects Paul, is that he then has to take on the dad role. He has to be the one, not even the dad, the ruler of the planet, like, because everything's under threat, and now he's got to try and raise this army. And I think that progression really works for him. It really works for him as a character. It really works for, I think...
Well, it's interesting that you mentioned that, Sam, because, like, actually, this movie kind of, like... That's kind of like the next movie. We keep seeing flashes throughout this movie.
Flashes, you're right.
The next movie. And I don't think he has come to the conclusion by the end of this movie that I'm going to raise an army and I'm going to battle the Harkonnen.
No.
But I don't know what you mean, because the movie is telling us that, literally. But it's kind of like, you do see the development of, like, by the end of this movie, Paul is responsible for his own destiny. He's very much grasped it and said...
Which we see in the fight, though, in the duel with the Fremen guy. Freeman, get it? Hey, like, the Fremen guy.
It's a 1965
sci-fi. Come on, I know, please.
It's not going to be subtle.
It's not, it's
Duncan,
just
Idaho, stays left.
Yeehaw. It's a Western. We'll call him Duncan, Idaho. It's a Western in space. Yippee-ki-yay. Hold on.
Do you want to talk about the mother?
I just want to talk about Charlemagne just specifically, and then we can talk about his relationship to the mother, because I think Charlemagne is, he's just this, like, magical actor. He is somebody that I am very, very keen to see more and more of. Interstellar, first thing, where he's got he's a handsome man. Interstellar is the first thing that, but that's before he was Timothy Chalamet. And I think that is this is an actor I think we're going to see a lot of, and probably get a little bit sick of, maybe, because he's
and we kind of have, like, again, I think he's appeared in a lot of movies that are on our radar a lot.
Have you seen the new Willy Wonka?
I have not.
I tell you what, Dave, now I love the first one, and I think it's a fantastic, I really enjoyed the new one, and I was so going in there thinking, this is going to be 2 hours, keep the kids quiet. And you know what? They absolutely nailed it. And I think so much of it comes on the shoulders of this relatively young actor, just like this movie, who's able to I don't know where this comes from as an actor, because watching him interviewed on Graham Norton. And I think he was on stage with, like, Julia Roberts and Tom Hanks. You know, and he was so quiet. And he just kept saying, I shouldn't be here. Why am I here? Like, you've got literally the A-list. You've got the king and queen of Hollywood standing next to me. And I don't know what to say. I'm here. Like, and I just think, I always want to appreciate how difficult it is for someone who's 28, even younger than that when he made this, to fill that fucking role and to turn up on set every day with all of these experienced actors and to be able to deliver something like this, I think is impressive. Well, acting is fucking hard. And
He's good.
He's great.
Adaptable. I've mostly seen him in smaller sort of supporting roles, again, partly because we're not watching a lot of
Go movies. Watch Wonka. Do it. It's fun.
Yeah.
Just stop being such he's a, in, stop being really such a in, nerd.
In the French Dispatch, he has a romantic relationship with Frances McDormand in Yes.
I'm not questioning it. Both of them. Fantastic. Let's do this.
In a segment where about 40% of the characters are subtitled and speaking French. And then for some reason, Timothy Chalamet and Frances McDormand. It's really funny. It's the French Dispatch. It's so good. Really funny. And they're like, really, really good performance. And just generally. And in this, yeah, you're right. It's hard to imagine anyone else in this role of like carrying off this kind of like vulnerability, I think, for this character. And I can only assume that's what the direction was.
Rebecca Ferguson then as Lady Jessica, his mum. She's got a trope, isn't it? An interesting job to do here, hasn't she? Because she is like this witch, mythical. She's also. I think I probably didn't have this problem when I read it initially because I was a lot younger. But now I definitely see, like, this is a man movie. This is a man story about how one man died and another, and his son basically...
And it's a man story in the
grew
way
his
that
balls and...
Because
and stop
it's a sci-fi book written by men for men.
For men, yeah.
About men. Yeah. In the book, and I think they go some of the way to, I think, fleshing out this role and making her a much more interesting character. In the book, she's kind of a plot device. Yeah. Lady Jessica exists to impart a lot of exposition in the book.
Oh, so much.
Help Paul get to where he's going to, and then she kind of disappears. I can't actually remember what happens to her. I think she dies. Anyway, it's hard to remember. But, like... I think the film goes a lot of the way to kind of like making this character more interesting, which is good because there are no women in this movie.
We're not interested in women. Are we?
There are three women in this movie, but there are so few women in this movie.
Well, we do have the doctor, don't we? Sharon Duncan Brewster, who is, I think, again, doesn't, it's not particularly well developed in terms of like the role, but yeah. There's something I think that's really important about this character is because, but all of it's about how it relates to Paul, and she's not really there.
Duncan Brewster, by the way, sorry, that's a good example of a gender flipped character. He's a man in the book.
Oh right. Oh, good call. Good
sorry,
shout.
I was just double checking that.
I hadn't realized that.
And I kind of wish they'd done more of it, but like. But that's fine. Women in the book, in the film, and then just let's ignore the fact this was written in 1965 by a white man who was patted on the back by a bunch of other white men about how this was great for white men.
Fantastic. Everyone wins, except everyone else. But last point on Lady Jessica, because I think she is such an essential character. Obviously, she's teaching Paul how to do the voice stuff, which is very important, but also she's kind of there to help him and to shove him out there, and there is an interesting story there about like the role of a parent to get out of your kid's way. Like, you shouldn't, you know, you as a parent, you need to be able to not have an ego and to sit back and let your kids.
And she
get
is
on
and, generally and, really supportive and like, yeah, you should have had him crash the helicopter later, so maybe work on that next time. God knows. But like, she isn't like, no, let me do it. Is that supportive, wanting her son to grow and his powers to grow, etc.
It'd be interesting to see how they progress that in part two.
Yes,
again,
I can't
remember how that what happens in the book, but it's still through the lens of a man. It's still through the lens of a son, and I think there's maybe some more work that could have been done there to try and give her
Definitely. Yeah. But I think you're always going to run into that problem when you adapt. A 60-year-old.
It's exactly, and we're still. There's no progress really. Where do we want to go? Small mentions. Dave Bautista. I think he's just excellent. I love him almost in every
he
single
plays
role.
Plays a really
he's
good
in.
Sith guy.
Skarsgård covered in oil. Hey, absolutely. Look at this fat suit. I presume it's a fat suit. I presume he didn't do this just for fun.
Do you know what confused me actually? And I had to Google it after I'd watched the film. As I read the book, I couldn't remember. I don't know if they explained it in the film. Why is this guy flying? I was watching it and thinking, why is he flying? No one else is flying.
Is he a worm?
Why is he flying?
Is it this is and a worm guy, right?
In the book, And it, and again, I think it's like a really like, it's one of the things in the book that I think is really evocative, is like, this guy's fucking like, he's fat as shit because he's like, he's corpulent, he's greedy, he just eats and eats and eats.
He's eating tomatoes like the steward in The Lord of the Rings, you know, in that amazing scene when
Denethor,
when Pippin's singing and I'm spurting everything. Like, it's just, there's just this decadence to him. I love it.
There is. In the book, basically, he's so fat that he can no longer like carry his weight around. So in the book, he's got these kind of like expensive, like tech, kind of like rocket booster things on his waist to get him about around because he's too fat to walk.
Just like Wall. And
exactly. And so, but it's a huge plot thing because it, like, when the scene where he kills Duke Atreides, Duke Atreides kills himself and releases the poison, which is cool, really, really cool. And they come in, and again, visually, I think it really fucking works. It absolutely nailed it. And he's on the ceiling because he's like rocket boosted up. But I was like, but why can he fly? Because I think it's a scene I just missed. Because I was like, but why is he flying? What? Nobody else can fly.
What?
But what it is it's a real, like, again, it's the books. And this is what the film does well, is it doesn't stop dead to explain, like, everything a thousand
just
times.
Just let it wash
you,
over you.
It tells you once, and if you miss it, it's the same thing with, like, the personal armor. It tells you once, if you miss it, it's fine, you'll catch up.
Mm-hmm. Just let it wash over you. Let's talk about it washing over you. Just before that, though, let's have a little mention for David Dasmalchain. You don't know who that is. He was William Borden in Oppenheimer, and he was, who was he in this? What's he called in this? He's Peter DeVries. He's also the insane guy in Dark Knight that Joker hires.
What's he called?
David Malchain, maybe. Just Google him. Just Google him. You'll never be able to spell it. But basically, if you look at the character list, you'll recognize his face. This guy pops up in movies, and I fucking love every single time, every single performance that I see from this actor. I think he is brilliant. He was Thomas Schiff in The Dark Knight. And
oh, David Dasmalchain.
I don't know, give it your best shot. He pops up and he's got this great face, and he's just brilliant character actor face, and I just really, really appreciate the roles that I see him in. Every time I'm like, wow, that's great, that was brilliant, whatever you, that is fantastic. And just a small mention, he was good in Dark Knight, in Oppenheimer, where he was like the traitor.
He gets Marvel movies, I think.
Ant-Man and stuff. Anyway, let's talk about this. Go on.
I was just going to say, I think the cast generally is. We haven't mentioned Josh Brolin, but he's not really a major character. Momoa is good. It's important to get the smaller roles right.
For an ensemble movie like this, which is basically a mini-series, you know, that's the kind of caliber we're at, isn't it?
It's the Game of Thrones thing.
You've got Sean Bean showing up for one season.
Tons of action in this movie, but there's also, like, lots and lots and lots and lots of library scenes, which is an Imaginary Movies podcast trademark term. There's lots and lots of library scenes.
Yeah, and let's talk about like how that washes over, because this is to me is the ultimate success of this movie, is that we get quite a lot of exposition, not as much as the book, not as much I think as you need, but we basically get a lot of the people sat in a circle talking about what they're gonna do with the One Ring in the Elven town in Lord of the Rings, like. Well, and my axe, and we'll smash it, and no, that doesn't work. Okay, so what? Like, we get a lot of this type of interaction, and so much of it, I think, didn't really connect in terms of like me following the logic of the story or really understanding. But at the start of this episode, I said, like, you come away with the emotion, and actually, the ability for this movie to get you to the same point. That you don't have a perfect grasp of what's going on, but you have enough. My favorite example is the scene you've already mentioned, where Skarsgård is looming over Oscar Isaacs, and he's about to pop the the cyanide pill and kill everyone in the room and they really injure Skarsgård. And like, I couldn't tell you for shit what they were talking about. I have no idea. You know, I couldn't actually give you a single, a basic summary. But what I saw was the physical fucking mass of Skarsgård leaning, you know, from the side, and you can see, and his weight and his presence, and Oscar Isaac lying back in his chair. He's been kind of like tranquilized or whatever. And that, like, visual fucking storytelling, Dave. That storytelling. Yeah. It doesn't matter what they're saying. I get it. I get it, movie. And thank you very much for making it so apparent to me that I can just let this film, I can just let the visuals wash over me. And it does it all the way through. That's fucking great, isn't it? Yeah. That's great.
It's just a testament to, like you said, good filmmaking. And we were talking, God help us. I was talking about going to see the second part two, still in the cinema now.
In the cinema. Good Lord.
And there were exactly two movies I've been to the cinema to watch since the pandemic, and it was Barbie and Oppenheimer last year, I think. I don't think I've been to the cinema apart from that. So it's like quite a big thing for us to like make the effort, because we're lazy as sin, to go out to the cinema. Sorry, busy. We are busy working adults.
I've got. I was at the cinema recently to see the new Ghostbusters Frozen Empire movie with my son and his friend, which was a nice experience. But oh god,
I fucking hate the cinema, Dave. I hate every single sitting there with all the people around me.
We can't do the Sam hates the cinema bit again.
It's just
clip it from an earlier episode. And
it's
just
a terrible
play it every time.
But Dave, you know, there are other ways. I was just thinking earlier, there are other ways that we could possibly try and watch that movie, but we'll just leave that one.
What I was saying was I think I will go to the cinema to watch this movie, because I think it will benefit from the big screen experience. And I liked the first one enough that I'm willing to do that for a sequel, and it's got good reviews.
And that's surprising, isn't it? Do you not think that's surprising?
Yeah.
Because I went in thinking, I'm going to hate this. This is going to be another fucking John Carter sci-fi bore fest. And I'm here for that. I love science fiction. I'll sit and get into whatever nerdy discussion you like about. But I really expected for this to be something smaller than what it was, something less artistic. I thought this was really actually quite artistic, and it had a lot of actual, you know, merit in terms of being able to tell a story that's very
rote, and it kind of
very
tropey. This is very borne out in the money it made. It's made tons of money. 432 million at box office on 165 million budget, which is great. Obviously, making a second one. I think they're making the third one now. There's a third one.
Are you kidding?
There's going to be three. There's going to be three, and I think they're only.
And they'll split the third one into two, and then there'll be seven movies, and then 45 movies later, Timothée Chalamet is now still looking 28, even though it's 2047.
But
it's called money, Dave. It's called money.
That's the bad place. But it's good, and it's entertaining, and it's kind of fun to see a property be adapted, because so many of them are bad. The Wheel of Time was bad. The Lord of the Rings, the new show, was bad. Like, so much of the stuff that gets adapted of your beloved properties is just trash. Like, you know, not everything. Like you said, you really like Wonka. That's an adaptation of an old property, and there's lots of other examples, but sometimes it's just poor.
Including other films that don't star Timothée Chalamet as well. I'm sure there are.
If I could think of them.
All right, Dave. Well, I think we've expressed our opinions. Now, let's do something silly. Yes, it's just the random quiz that we're going to do, because Dave wants to test my knowledge of whether I can remember a single character name or anything about this movie that I have definitely seen. Dave, what have you got for us today?
So, I have got six character names.
Six?
Three of them are from this series, right? And all three are characters in this film.
Oh, God. Right, I'm going to close the tab. to make sure, just so we can confirm, and the independent adjudicator is now confirming. I've not looking at the character names.
For reference, and I will tell you what the other three characters, what other property the other three characters are from once we've decided.
Oh, so these, I will you have made these up. These are actually this is not fair.
These are real, genuine
this is
names.
Not fair. I'm never going to be able to do this.
It is fair. Right, so I'm going to give you two names. I'm going to give you two names at a time, and you're going to tell me which one of them is from Dune. Okay?
Okay, I'm ready.
So, the first two names out are Padden Fane or Wellington Yu.
Padden Fane. Padden. What the fuck is that?
I can spell these if you'd like.
No, I don't. It doesn't. So what was the other one? Wellington. Wellington does feel
shit.
It's Duncan adjacent. Is my feeling. Does that make sense? Does that make any sense at all?
It does.
You're nodding. Duncan. I'm gonna go Wellington. Then is from Dune.
Wellington Yu is from Dune.
Oh yes.
He's the doctor, so he's the doctor who puts the.
Oh, of course he is. Dr. Yu, yeah. Wellington, yeah. Dr. Yu, right.
Because Wellington, because they don't say it because it's stupid.
Because they go, what? Yeah.
Yeah. So that's definitely a character in this movie. Just a quick sidebar here, because I noticed myself doing it. You keep saying June rather than.
You've done it as well.
I have to try and keep making myself say Dune because.
June. No, he don't.
I'm just saying June.
Sand June.
Like the month. Like Sand Dune.
Sand June.
No, but yeah, but it's like...
Sand it's... Dune. Dune. It's not Dune. I'm not saying Dune. It's Sand
English
Dune.
Is a stupid language.
We're stupid. Next
right,
question.
Number two. The characters are called Esmar Turk.
Oh, God. Hold on a second. Before we get to... where the fuck was Padme, whatever its face? The other three
names are all from the same series. I will tell you what it is.
Okay, tell me the end. All right, finished. Fair enough. Okay.
So, Esmar Turk
or
Min Farshaw.
Esmar Turk, Min Farshaw. Esmar... this honestly could be anything, couldn't it? Esmar Turk. Esmar Turk. I don't know.
It's correct.
Oh, yes. Who's that?
Don't know.
Oh.
I haven't got it.
What is it? Esmar?
Esmar Turk.
Esmar Turk. Here we go. Esmar Turk is not how you spell it. It's a... Turk's operation was spice smuggler.
Oh, so that's a character not from this movie. That will be from...
It wouldn't have mattered anyway. It's fine. 50-50 guess. Right, next one.
The next and last one. And you've already got two out of three, so you're doing really well here.
I am riding high.
Leandrin Garal or Fade Arautha?
Leandrin Garal. I'm thinking we've got like apostrophes in names here with Garal. That's like a... that feels like a... June.
What is it with these authors and apostrophes? I'll just put apostrophes.
Can we just talk about that for a second?
John Smith. John Smith.
It is one of my least favorite science fiction tropes, and it's kind of gone away now, I think. But it was almost like, I want to make a character sound really like almost like Oriental or something. There's like a weird like...
there's a colonial bent to it, certainly.
There's a weird thing going on there, and it's terrible. It's terrible. So I'm going to go confidently with whatever Leandra Giral.
No, that's incorrect.
Oh.
The correct answer was Fade, which is F-E-Y-D hyphen Rautha. R-A-U-T-H-A.
That's even worse. It's even worse.
I think that's one of the Fremen characters.
It would be, of course, because the Fremen definitely aren't people.
Indigenous coded.
They're definitely not that. They've got all the oil, and they've got weird names, and they walk around in turbans.
And
but
they're
don't
not
worry
white.
About it. but don't worry about it. It's definitely not anything like that. That's the line, and that's what the movie's taken to.
Yeah.
Who is that then? Who's that? It doesn't matter. Move on. So tell me, tell me the name of where the other ones came from then.
Have you got any guesses?
You've mentioned Wheel of Time, and there are 40,000 characters in that series, so that's a, you know, just throw a dart and see where it lands. It doesn't feel like Game of Thrones. It's a bit more kind of Western European, isn't it? Feely.
It is Wheel of Time.
Yeah, of course it is, yes.
Fade Rauther, by the way, is the younger brother of Dave Bautista, who appears in the second
movie. Oh, right, so who cares? Just irrelevant.
Yeah, the other three names are all from Wheel of Time. And it's funny because there were quite a few that I was like, nah, because I know, I think you've read that first book, because I couldn't have any of the main characters' names. So
the Wheel of Time book?
You've read one of them, haven't you?
I have absolutely not, and will never do that, Dave. Why would I do that to myself? 45 books later, and we're still some of the passages. That
I will
you've
say,
sent me,
this is a bold statement. You could not waste your time more than by reading all 14.
Hasn't your brother done books. It twice?
Yes, and I've read them all as well. And Dave, I really regret putting the time in.
Reassess your life, man.
Read the Wikipedia page, because it ain't getting.
No, I just don't care. I just don't have. There's something I just don't need to know.
It's kind of like on the level with the character names of, like, I just made up nonsense.
Like, hero protagonist.
One of the main characters in that's called Matt.
Just Matt. Hey, I'm Matt. Hi, Matt. Brilliant. Sorry to all the Matts out there.
This
sure
is inspired by the fact that Duncan Idaho is one of the stupider.
Character names. It's a brilliant name, isn't it? It's a brilliant name. All right, Dave. Well, there we go. And I think we'll have a smattering applause for your quiz there.
Hey, you got two out of three right there.
I'm feeling pretty good. I'm riding high. I don't know if I'm riding high enough to go see June in the cinema, though. That is maybe a line too far.
I was thinking, like I've got a longish day on Wednesday, or I'm going to Leeds, so drive back to go to the cinema and sit in the cinema 3 hours. Nice, quiet, dark, loud, exploding movie.
Mm-hmm.
There'll be no one there because it comes out of the cinema like next week.
So this is like the dregs. The dregs of
this
what's...
is the peak. This is the same thing I did with Barbie and Oppenheimer. There was like three people in the screening for Oppenheimer, I think, including me. So two other people.
Yeah.
Who were sat all the weird cinema thing here. I obviously picked a seat right in the middle of the middle row, right? For peak optical.
Although
viewing,
at the back,
right?
I would say at the back is a better experience, but that's fine. We're on the same row. In the middle.
It's fine.
In the middle. Yeah.
And the couple that were there were sat two rows down from me and on the very left edge in an empty cinema.
That, honestly, what are you doing?
What an insane way. What
like, if you don't have a choice, if you don't have a choice, fine.
It's fine, but we don't have a choice. Yeah, you sit where you can sit.
It's pure madness. I mean, let's just have another hour on why going to the cinema is madness. Anyway.
I mean, this like, was 1 p.m. on a Thursday in Northampton. Yeah. So I guess, like, you know,
they maybe
anyway.
They don't have much more to do. Well, you know, as I said, I'm curious. I'm curious to watch the next June, but I don't think I'm curious enough to go to cinema and watch it, which only leaves me with two options. Don't watch it, or Dave, I could, you know, maybe I stumble across it, maybe it just happens to be in front of my face and we can talk about it next week. I don't know how that would happen, but you know, maybe, who knows.
I couldn't possibly, for legal reasons, comment.
No,
the thing means internet piracy.
Piracy. The views of Dave do not represent the views of the Imaginary Movie Podcast. Please direct all letters to his P.O. Box. P.O. Box, Dave is a dirty pirate.
Yo ho ho.